The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 3, Continued. Cassette 15, Side 1. For habitual criminals sentenced to close confinement, all the things in my list are no privation at all. The present disciplinary regimes are the only thing that can teach them sense. Two painful jerks at my strings. They are the experts here. They know best who is inside. Restore them to society? Yes, of course, the old men say in wooden voices. And what I hear is, no, of course, let them all die. It'll make our lives easier, and yours, too. The disciplinary regimes? One of the veterans of Ochakov, a public prosecutor, the one in blue with the star on his chest and sparse ringlets of grey hair, who even looks a little like Suvorov. We have already begun to see a return from the introduction of strict regimes. Instead of 2,000 murders a year, here it can be said, there are only a few dozen. An important figure. I make a discreet note of it. This appears to be the most useful result of my visit. Who is inside? Of course, to argue about prison regimes, you have to know who is inside. Dozens of psychologists and lawyers would have to go and talk to the prisoners without obstruction. Then we should be in a position to argue. This is just the one thing my camp correspondents never put in their letters, why they and their comrades are inside. The great variety of these habitual criminals defeats the imagination. In the Tavdinsk colony, for instance, there is an 87-year-old, formerly an officer in the Tsar's army, and probably in one of the White Armies, too. By 1962, he had served 18 years of his second 20. He has a beard, like Father Christmas, and works as a tally clerk in a glove factory. We can't help wondering whether 40 years' imprisonment is not rather a high price to pay for the beliefs of your youth. And there are so many unfortunates of this sort, each of them unique. We should have to find out about every one of them before we could form a judgment on the regime imposed on them all. The general part of our discussion is at an end, and we turn to particulars. The Commission, of course, has no doubts, and has already made up its mind about everything. I can be of no use to them. They were merely curious to know what I look like. Parcels? Only 5 kilograms at a time? And at the same intervals as at present. I suggest that they should at least double the number allowed and make the parcels 8 kilograms each. They're hungry in there. Starvation is no way to reform criminals. What do you mean, hungry? The Commission's indignation is unanimous. We've been there ourselves and seen leftover bread carried out of a camp by the truckload. For the warder's pigs, you mean? What can I do? Shout, you're lying? That just can't be true. But I feel a painful tug at my tongue, attached by a thread running over my shoulders to a place behind my back. I must not violate our working assumptions. They are well informed. They are sincere. They care. Shall I show them the letters from my Zex? It would all be Greek to them, and the well-thumbed, crumpled scraps of paper would look absurd and contemptible on the red velvet tablecloth. But it costs the state nothing to allow more parcels. Ah, but who will benefit from them? They retort. Mainly rich families. They use the word rich. Realistic discussion of policy cannot do without it. Those who have a lot of stolen goods hidden outside, so that by increasing the number of parcels we should put working families at a disadvantage. Now the threads are cutting and tearing. This is an unchallengeable assumption. The interests of the toiling strata are above everything else. They are, of course, only sitting here for the good of the toiling strata. I find myself lost for an answer. I don't know what retort I can make. I could say, I'm not convinced, and a fat lot they would care. What do I think I am, their boss or something? I keep pushing. What about the shops? Where does the socialist principle of remuneration come in? If a man's earned something, give it to him. They hit back. He has to build up reserves for when he is released. Otherwise, when he gets out, he becomes a charge on the state. The interests of the state come first. That's stitched on my back. I dare not tug at it. nor can I suggest that prisoners' wages should be raised at the state's expense. Well, at least let their Sundays off be sacrosanct. That's provided for. They are. But there are dozens of ways of ruining a Sunday in camp. Say expressly that no one must do so. We can't include such minute regulations in the code. The camps work an 8-hour day. I half-heartedly put it to them that 7 hours is enough, but in my own mind I know that this is impertinence. It isn't a 12 or a 10-hour day. Will you never be satisfied? Correspondence gives the prisoner a feeling of participation in the life of our socialist society. Such were the arguments I had taught myself to use. Why restrict it? But they cannot reconsider. The allowance is fixed, and not so harshly as in our day. They show me also the schedule of visits, including private 3-day visits, and we, of course, had none at all for years, so this seems tolerable. Indeed, the arrangements for visits seems quite generous to me, and I barely restrain myself from praising them. I am tired. I am completely sewn up. I can't stir a muscle. I'm doing no good here. It's time to go. And indeed, seen from this bright, festive room, from these comfortable armchairs, to the accompaniment of their smoothly flowing eloquence, the camps look not horrible, but quite rational. You see, leftover bread by the truckload. Well, would you let these terrible people loose on the community? I remember the master thieves and their ugly mugs. It's 10 years since I was in myself. How can I begin to guess who is there now? My sort, the politicals, are supposed to have been freed. The national groups have been released. The other disagreeable old man wants my views on hunger strikes. Surely I cannot disapprove of forced feeding if the food given is more nourishing than gruel. But from Marchenko we learn of a new practice, pouring hot water down the tube to damage the esophagus. I get up on my hind legs and bellow at them that a Zek has every right not only to go on a hunger strike, his only means of self-defense, but to starve himself to death. My arguments seem crazy to them, but I am all sewn up. I cannot talk about the connection between hunger strikes and public opinion in the country at large. I leave, feeling tired and jaded. I even feel a little less sure of myself, whereas they are not the least bit shaken. They will do just as they please, and the Supreme Soviet will confirm it unanimously. Vadim Stepanovich Tikhonov, Minister for the Protection of Public Order. What wild fantasy is this? Can I, the miserable convict SHCH-232, be on my way to teach the Minister of Internal Affairs how to run the archipelago? On the approaches to the minister, nothing but colonels, bullet-headed, sleekly pallid, but very agile. No door leads on beyond the chief secretary's room. Where it should be stands an enormous mirror-fronted cupboard with gathered silk curtains behind the glass, big enough to take 2 men on horseback. And this turns out to be the vestibule of the minister's sanctum. His office would seat 200 comfortably. The minister himself is unhealthily fat, with a heavy jaw. His face is a trapezium, broadening toward the chin. Throughout the conversation, his manner is strictly official. He hears me out as a matter of duty, but with no sign of interest. I launch at him the same old tirade about health resorts, and once again the same old questions. Is it our common aim, his and mine, to reform the Zeks? My views on reform are behind us in Part 4. Why the sharp change of course in 1961? Why those 4 camp regimes? I repeat boring things for him, all the things I've written in this chapter about diet, camp shops, parcels, clothing, work, bullying warders, the mentality of the practical workers. I have chosen not to bring the letters in case someone here pounces on them, and have simply copied out excerpts, omitting the author's names. I go on talking to him for 40 minutes or an hour. It seems a very long time anyway. And I am surprised myself that he is listening to me. He interrupts now and then, but only to accept or reject some statement outright. He does not attempt a crushing refutation. I was expecting a blank wall of arrogance, but he is much softer. He agrees with much of what I say. He agrees that shopping money must be increased, and that there should be more parcels, and that there is no need to define the contents of parcels as minutely, as the Legislative Proposals Commission does. But this does not depend on him. The new corrective labor code, not the minister, will decide all these things. He agrees that prisoners should be allowed to boil or bake food they have acquired themselves, except that they never have any, and that there should be no limit to letters and printed matter sent through the mails, though this would put a great burden on the camp censorship. He is even against martinets who overdo drills and line-ups, but it wouldn't be tactful to interfere. It's easy to wreck discipline, difficult to impose it. He agrees that the grass in the camp area should not be weeded out. What had happened in Dubrovlag around the engineering workshops was quite another matter. They had planted little kitchen gardens. The machine operators busied themselves there during their break, and each man had 2 or 3 square meters sown with tomatoes or cucumbers. But the minister ordered them to dig it all under, to destroy it at once, and he's proud of it. I tell him that man's ties with the earth have a moral importance, and he tells me that individual garden plots foster property-owning instincts. The minister even shudders at the thought that people had been sent back behind the wire after living outside. I don't like to ask what his position was at the time and what he did to prevent it. More than all this, the minister acknowledges that Zeks are kept in harsher conditions now than in the days of Ivan Denisovich. This being so, I need not waste my time persuading him. There is nothing for us to discuss, and it is pointless for him to take note of suggestions from someone with no official position. What can I suggest? Breaking up the whole archipelago and letting prisoners live without guards? I can't get the words out. It's utopian. And anyway, the solution of a big problem never depends on a single individual. It winds snake-like through many departments and is at home in none. On the other hand, the minister is emphatically sure that the striped uniform for habitual criminals is necessary. If you only knew what sort of people they are. My critical remarks about warders and convoy troops simply offend him. You are confused, or else your own experiences have given you a peculiar way of looking at things. He assures me that you can no longer round up recruits for the prison service, because the old privileges have been done away with. It shows a healthy attitude on the part of ordinary people if they won't join up, I almost exclaim. But I feel the warning tug of the strings at my ears, my eyelids, my tongue. However, I am overlooking something. It's only sergeants and corporals who won't join. You can't keep the officers out. They have to make use of conscripts. Contradicting me again, the minister tells me that only prisoners use vulgar abuse, while warders are invariably correct in their manner of speaking to prisoners. When there is such a discrepancy between the letters of insignificant Zeks and the words of a minister, whom shall we believe? Clearly, the prisoners are lying. He even quotes his own observation at first hand, because he, of course, does see something of the camps, and I do not. Perhaps I would like to visit one? Kriukovo or Dubrovlag? These two names come to him so easily that they are obviously Potemkin structures. Besides, in what capacity would I go? As a ministry inspector? If I did, I couldn't look the Zeks in the face. I refuse. The minister, disagreeing with me, expresses the view that Zeks lack feeling and do not respond to the efforts made for them. You go to the Magnitogorsk colony and ask, "Any complaints about your treatment?" And, with the head of the camp division standing by, would you believe it, they shout in chorus, "None!" Now for what the minister sees as splendid results of the re-education program in the camps. A machine operator's pride when the head of his camp division commended him. The pride of prisoners whose work, they made kettles, was destined for heroic Cuba. The reports and elections of internal order sections, that is, a bitch went walking. The abundance of flowers provided by the state in Dubrovlag. His main concern is to create in every camp an industrial base of its own. The minister reckons that by increasing the number of interesting jobs, he can cut out escape attempts. All the more easily because, as we now know from Marchenko, they no longer try to catch escapers, but just shoot them down. When I object that all human beings long for freedom, he simply doesn't understand. I left with the weary conviction that there was no end to it. that I had not advanced my cause by a hairbreadth, and that they would always take a sledgehammer to crack a nut. I left depressed by the realization that two human minds could think so differently. Zek will understand, Minister, when he ensconces himself in a ministerial sanctum, and Minister will understand Zek when he, too, goes behind the wire, has his own garden plot trodden down, and in return for his freedom is offered the chance to master a machine. Institute for the Study of the Origins of Criminality. This was an interesting discussion with two cultured deputy directors and several members of the research staff, lively people, each with his own opinions, given to arguing among themselves. Afterward, V.N. Kudryavtsev, one of the deputy directors, chided me as he led me along the corridor. "It's all very well, but you don't take all points of view into account. Now, Tolstoy would have done so." And suddenly I found that he had tricked me into taking a wrong turn. "We'll just look in and meet the director, Igor Ivanovich Karpets." This visit was not part of the plan. We'd finished our discussion. What was the point of it? "Well, all right, I'll drop in to shake hands." I need not have expected a polite exchange of greetings here. It was hard to believe that the deputy directors and heads of section I had seen worked for a boss like this, that he presided over all their research. The most important thing about him I would learn much later. Karpets was vice president of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers. The man who rose to meet me was hostile and disdainful. As I remember it, we remained on our feet throughout our five-minute conversation, as if he were reluctantly granting an interview for which I had begged and pleaded. In his face I saw well-fed prosperity, firmness, and distaste for me. With no thought for his nice suit, he had pinned a large badge on his chest as though it were a medal, a vertical sword piercing something down below, over the legend MVD. This appears to be a very important badge. It shows that the wearer has had clean hands, fire in his heart, and a cool head, much longer than most. "Let's have it, then. What have you been talking about?" he asks, with a scowl. I have no use for him at all, but out of politeness I repeat some of it. "Oh, that," says the Democratic lawyer, as though he had heard enough. "Liberalization, eh? Babying the Zeks." Then suddenly out they come, full answers to all the questions which I had carried in vain over marble floors and between mirrored walls. "Raise the living standards of prisoners can't be done, because the free people around the camp would be living less well than the Zeks, which cannot be allowed. Receive parcels frequently and bigger ones can't be done, because this would have a bad effect on the warders who get no food from Moscow shops. Reprimand warders and teach them to behave better can't be done. We're trying to hold on to them. Nobody wants the job, we can't pay much, and some of their privileges have been taken away. We deny prisoners payment for their work according to socialist principles. Their own fault, they've cut themselves off from our socialist society. But don't we want to reclaim them for normal life? Reclaim them?" The sword-bearer is astonished. "That's not what the camps are about. A camp is a place of retribution." Retribution. The word fills the whole room. Retribution. Retribution. The sword stands upright to smite, to pierce. You'll never ease it out again. Retribution. The archipelago was, the archipelago remains, the archipelago will stand forever. Without it, who can be made to suffer for the errors of the vanguard doctrine, for the fact that people will not grow into the shapes devised for them? Chapter 3. The Law Today. The reader has seen throughout this book that from the very beginning of the Stalin age there have been no politicals in our country. The crowds, the millions driven past while you watched, all those millions of 58s, were merely common criminals. Besides, merry, mouthy Nikita Sergeyevich took so many bows from so many platforms. Politicals? Not a one. We just don't have them. And as grief grew forgetful, as distant softened craggy contours, as fat formed under the skin. We almost believed it. Even former Zeks did. Millions of Zeks were released for all to see, so perhaps there really were no politicals left. We had returned, others joined us, our friends and families were back. The gaps in our little world of urban intellectuals seemed to be filled, the ring closed, you could sleep undisturbed, and no one would have been taken from the house when you woke. Friends would telephone, no one was missing. Not that we altogether believed it, but for practical purposes we accepted that there were no longer any politicals in jail. Well, yes, even today, 1968, a few hundred bolts are not allowed to go home to their republics, and the curse has not been lifted from the Crimean Tatars, but very soon, no doubt. From outside, as always, as indeed under Stalin, all was clean and tidy, nothing showed. And Nikita was there, glued to his platform. There can be no return to deeds and occurrences such as these, either in the party or in the country, generally. May 22, 1959. That was before Novocherkassk. Now everyone in our country can breathe freely, with no need to worry about the present or the future. March 8, 1963, after Novocherkassk. Novocherkassk, a town of fateful significance in Russia's history. As though the Civil War had not left scars enough, it thrust itself beneath the saber yet again. Novocherkassk, a whole town rebels, and every trace is licked clean and hidden. Even under Khrushchev, the fog of universal ignorance remained so thick that no one abroad got to know about Novocherkassk. There were no Western broadcasts to inform us of it, and even local rumor was stamped out before it could spread. So that the majority of our fellow citizens do not know what event is associated with the name Novocherkassk and the date June 2, 1962. Let me then put down here all that I have been able to gather. We can say without exaggeration that this was a turning point in the modern history of Russia. If we leave out the Ivanovo weavers at the beginning of the 30s, theirs was a large-scale strike, but it ended without violence. The flare-up at Novocherkassk was the first time the people had spoken out in 41 years, since Kronstadt and Tambov. Unorganized, leaderless, unpremeditated, it was a cry from the soul of a people who could no longer live as they had lived. On Friday, June 1, one of those carefully considered enactments of which Khrushchev was so fond was published throughout the Union, raising the prices of meat and butter. On that very same day, as demanded by another and quite separate economic plan, piece rates at the huge electric locomotive works in Novocherkassk, NEVZ, were lowered, in some cases by 30%. That morning, the workers in two shops, the forge and the foundry, usually obedient creatures of habit, geared to their jobs, could not force themselves to work, so hot had things become for them. Their loud, excited discussions developed into a spontaneous mass meeting, an everyday event in the West, an extraordinary one for us. Neither the engineers nor the chief engineer himself could persuade them. Kurochkin, the works manager, arrived. When the workers asked him, "What are we going to live on now?" this well-fed parasite answered, "You're used to guzzling meat pies. Put jam in them instead." He and his retinue barely escaped being torn to pieces. Perhaps if he had answered differently, it would all have blown over. By noon, the strike had spread throughout the enormous locomotive works. Runners were sent to other factories, where the workers wavered, but did not come out in support. The Moscow-Rostov railway line runs close to the works, either to make sure that the news would reach Moscow more quickly, or to prevent troops and tanks from moving in. A large number of women sat down on the tracks to hold up trains, whereupon the men began pulling up the rails and building barriers. Strike action of such boldness is unusual in the history of the Russian workers' movement. Slogans appeared on the works building. "Down with Khrushchev! Use Khrushchev for sausage meat!" While all this was happening, troops and police began converging on the works, which stands, with its settlement, 3 to 4 kilometers from Novocherkassk, across the river Tuzlov. Tanks took up position on the bridge over the Tuzlov. From evening until the following morning, movement inside the city or across the bridge was completely forbidden. Even during the night, the workers' settlement did not quiet down for a moment. Overnight, About 30 workers were arrested as ringleaders and carried off to the city police station. On the morning of June the 2nd, some other enterprises in the town struck, but by no means all of them. Another spontaneous mass meeting at NEVZ decided on a protest march into the town to demand the release of the arrested workers. The procession, only about 300 strong to begin with, you had to be brave, with women and children in its ranks, carrying portraits of Lenin and peaceful slogans, marched over the bridge past the tanks without obstruction, then uphill into the town. Here, their numbers were quickly swelled by curious onlookers, individual workers from other enterprises, and little boys. At several places in the city, people stopped lorries and used them as platforms for speech-making. The whole town was seething. The NEVZ demonstrators marched along the main street, Moskovskaya, and some of them began trying to break down the locked doors of the town police station in the belief that their arrested comrades were inside. They were met with pistol shots. Further on, the street led to the Lenin Monument. It had replaced Klotz's statue of Ataman Platonov, which had been melted down for scrap. And by two narrow paths around a public garden to the headquarters of the town party committee, formerly the Ataman's palace in which General Kaledin had shot himself in 1918. All the streets were choked with people, and here, on the square, the crowd was densest. Many little boys had climbed trees in the garden to get a better view. The party offices were found to be empty. The city authorities had fled to Rostov. The first secretary of the Rostov Oblast Party Committee, Basov, whose name, together with that of Kiev, commander of the North Caucasus military district, will one day be inscribed over the site of the mass shooting, had arrived in Novocherkassk in the meantime, but had rushed back to Rostov in terror. It is even said that he made his escape by jumping from a second-story balcony. Immediately after the Novocherkassk events, he went with a delegation to heroic Cuba. Inside the building, there was broken glass, and the floors were strewn with documents, as they must have been after a retreat in the Civil War. A couple of dozen workers walked through the palace, came out on its long balcony, and harangued the crowd in halting speeches. It was about 11 a.m. There were no police to be seen in the town, but there were more and more troops. A revealing picture. At the first slight shock, the civil authorities hid behind the army. Soldiers had occupied the post office, the radio station, the bank. By this time, the whole of Novocherkassk was beleaguered, and every entry and exit barred. For this task, they had brought in, among others, cadets from the officers' training schools in Rostov, leaving some behind to patrol that city. Tanks crawled slowly along Moskovskaya Street, following the route the demonstrators had taken toward party headquarters. Boys started scrambling onto the tanks and obstructing the observation slits. The tanks fired a few blank shells, rattling the windows of shops and houses all along the street. The boys scattered, and the tanks crawled on. And the students? Novocherkassk is, of course, a town of students. Where were they all? The students of some institutes, including the Polytechnic and of some technical secondary schools, had been locked in their dormitories or in other school buildings from early morning. Their rectors had thought quickly. But we may as well say it. The students, for their part, showed little civic courage. They were presumably glad of this excuse to do nothing. It would take more than the turn of a key to hold back rebel students in the West today, and took more in Russia in days gone by. A scuffle broke out inside the party building. Step by step, the speakers were dragged back inside and soldiers emerged onto the balcony, more and more of them. Remember how the military observed the Kengir mutiny from the balcony of the Steplag head office? A file of riflemen began forcing the crowd back from the small square immediately before the palace toward the railings of the garden. Several witnesses say unanimously that these soldiers were all non-Russians, Caucasians brought in from the other end of the oblast to replace the cordon from the local garrison previously posted there. But not all witnesses agree that the previous cordon had been ordered to open fire, and that the order was not carried out because the captain who received it killed himself in front of his men rather than pass it on. According to this version, the soldiers who refused to fire into the crowd were exiled to Yakutia. That an officer committed suicide is beyond doubt, but accounts of the circumstances are vague, and no one knows the name of this hero of conscience? The crowd backed away, but no one expected the worst. It is not known who gave the order, but these soldiers raised their rifles and fired a first volley over the heads of the crowd. Those who stood near enough know, but they were either killed or taken out of circulation. Perhaps General Pliev had no immediate intention of firing on the crowd. Perhaps the situation got out of hand. The burst fired over the heads of the crowd found the trees in the little garden and the boys who had climbed into them, some of whom fell to the ground. The crowd, it seems, gave a roar, whereupon the soldiers, whether at a command or because they saw red or in panic, started firing freely into the crowd, and yes, with dum-dum bullets. There is reliable evidence that 47 were killed by dum-dum bullets alone. Remember Kangir, the 16 at the guardhouse? The crowd fled in panic, jamming the narrow paths around the garden, but the troops went on firing at their backs as they retreated. They continued firing until the large square beyond the garden and the Lenin statue was completely empty, all along the former Platovsky Prospect and as far as Moskovskaya Street. An eyewitness says that the area looked like one great mound of corpses, but many of those lying there were, of course, only wounded. Information from a variety of sources is more or less unanimous that some 70 or 80 people were killed, rather fewer than before the Winter Palace, yet all Russia was outraged by January the 9th and observed its anniversary yearly. When shall we begin commemorating June the 2nd? The soldiers looked around for lorries and buses, commandeered them, loaded them with the dead and the wounded, and dispatched them to the high-walled military hospital. For a day or two afterward, these buses went around with blood-stained seats. That day, just as in Kangir, movie cameras took pictures of the rebels on the streets. The firing ceased, the terror passed, the crowd poured back onto the square, and was fired upon again. All this happened between noon and 1 p.m. This is what an observant witness saw at 2 p.m. There are about 8 tanks of different types standing on the square in front of party headquarters. A cordon of soldiers stands before them. The square is almost deserted. There are only small groups of people, mostly youngsters, standing about and shouting at the soldiers. On the square, puddles of blood have formed in the depressions in the pavement. I am not exaggerating. I never suspected till now that there could be so much blood. The benches in the public garden are splattered with blood. There are bloodstains on its sanded paths and on the whitewashed tree trunks in the public garden. The whole square is scored with tank tracks. A red flag, which the demonstrators had been carrying, is propped against the wall of party headquarters, and a grey cap splashed with red-brown blood has been slung over the top of its pole. Across the facade of the party building hangs a red banner, there for some time past. The people and the party are one. People go up to the soldiers to curse them or to appeal to their conscience. How could you do it? Who did you think you were shooting at? Your own people you were shooting at. They make excuses. It wasn't us. We've only just been brought in and posted here. We had nothing to do with it. That's how efficient our murderers are. And yet people talk about bureaucratic sluggishness. Those soldiers have already been taken away and perplexed Russians put in their place. He knows his business, that General Pliev. Toward 5 or 6 o'clock, the square gradually filled with people again. They were brave, the people of Novocherkassk. The town radio kept appealing to them. Citizens, do not fall for provocation. Go home quietly. The riflemen still stood there. The blood had not been mopped up. And again they pressed forward. Shouts from the crowd, more and more people, and another impromptu meeting. They knew by now that 6 senior members of the Central Committee had flown in, probably arriving before the first shootings. Among them, needless to say, Mikoyan, the expert on Budapest-type situations, and Frol Kodzlov. The names of the other 4 are not known for certain. They stayed in the Cook's building, formerly the headquarters of the Cadet Corps, as though it were a fortress. And a delegation of younger workers from NEVZ was sent to tell them what had happened. A buzz went through the crowd. Let Mikoyan come down here. Let him see all this blood for himself. Mikoyan wouldn't come down, thank you. but a reconnaissance helicopter flew low over the square around 6 o'clock, inspected it, flew off again. Shortly afterward, the workers' delegation came back from Cook's. As agreed, the military cordon let the delegates through, and officers escorted them to the balcony of the party building. Silence. The delegates reported to the crowd that they had seen the Central Committee members and told them about this bloody Saturday, and that Kozlov had wept when he heard about the children falling from the trees at the first volley. You know Frol Kozlov, the Leningrad Party gang boss, the cruelest of Stalinists? He wept. The Central Committee members had promised to investigate these events and severely punish those responsible, the very promises made to us in Osoblag. But for the present, everyone must go home to prevent the outbreak of fresh disorders in the town. The meeting, however, did not disperse. The crowd grew ever denser toward the evening, the desperate courage of Novocherkassk. There is a story that the Politburo team made the decision that evening to deport the whole population of the town, every last one of them. I can believe this. It would have been nothing extraordinary after the deportation of nations. Wasn't the same Mikoyan close to Stalin when that happened? Around 9 in the evening, they tried to drive the people away from the palace with tanks, but as soon as the drivers switched on their engines, people clustered around the tanks, blocking the hatches and the observation slits. The tanks stalled. The riflemen stood by and made no effort to help the tank crews. An hour later, tanks and armored personnel carriers appeared from the opposite side of the square, with an escort of Tommy gunners perched on top of them. Our battle experience counts for something. We are the ones who defeated the fascists. Advancing at high speed, to the jeers of young people on the footpaths, the students had been released toward evening. They cleared the roadways of Moskovskaya Street and the former Platovsky Prospect. At last, toward midnight, the riflemen began firing tracer bullets into the air, and the crowd slowly dispersed. What power there is in a popular disturbance, how quickly it changes the whole political situation. The night before, there had been a curfew, and people had been frightened anyway, but now the whole town was strolling about and hooting at the soldiers. A people transformed. Can it be so near to breaking through the crust of this half-century into a completely different atmosphere? On June the 3rd, the town radio broadcast speeches by Mikoyan and Kozlov. Kozlov did not weep, nor did they any longer promise to find the culprits, those in higher places. What they now said was that these events were the result of enemy provocation, and that these enemies would be severely punished. The people had, of course, gone from the square by now. Mikoyan said further that dum-dum bullets had never been adopted as part of the equipment of Soviet troops, and that they must therefore have been used by enemies of the state. But who were these enemies? How had they parachuted into the country? Where were they hiding? Show us just one. We are so used to being treated like fools. Enemies, they say, and all is explained. In the Middle Ages, it was devils. This is a woman, schoolteacher, from Novocherkassk, holding forth in a train in 1968. The military did not shoot anyone. They fired only one warning burst into the air. The shooting was done by saboteurs with dum-dum bullets. Where did they get them? Saboteurs can get absolutely anything. They shot at soldiers and workers alike. The workers seemed to go mad, attacked the soldiers and beat them. But how were the soldiers to blame? Afterward, Mikoyan walked around the streets and went into people's houses to see how they lived. The women offered him strawberries. This is all that history has preserved to date. The shops were immediately the richer for butter, sausage, and many other things not seen in those parts for a long time, or anywhere outside the capitals. The wounded all vanished without trace, not one of them went home. Instead, the families of the wounded and the killed, who of course wanted to know what had become of their kin, were deported to Siberia. So were many of those involved in the demonstration who had been noticed or photographed. Some participants were dealt with in a series of trials in camera. There were also two public trials, with entry by ticket for factory party officials and for the town apparatchiki. At one of these, 9 men were sentenced to be shot and 2 women to 15 years imprisonment. The membership of the town party committee remained as before. On the Saturday following Bloody Saturday, the town radio announced that the workers of the electric locomotive works have solemnly undertaken to fulfil their 7-year plan ahead of time. If the Tsar had not been such a ninny, he would have realised that all he needed to do on January the 9th in Petersburg was hunt down the workers carrying banners and pin charges of banditry on them. After that, there would have been no revolutionary movement worth mentioning. At Alexandrovo, in 1961, a year before Novocherkassk, the police beat a man to death while he was under arrest, and then would not allow his body to be carried past their precinct to the cemetery. The crowd was furious and burned down the police station. Arrests followed immediately. There was a similar incident about the same time in Murom. What would the appropriate charge now be? Under Stalin, even a tailor who stuck a needle in a newspaper could get Article 58. Now, a more sensible view was taken. Wrecking a police station should not be regarded as a political act. It was ordinary banditry. Instructions were handed down to this effect. Mass disorders should not be treated as political offences. If they're not political, what is? So all at once, there were no more politicals. But one stream has never dried up in the USSR and still flows, a stream of criminals untouched by the beneficent wave summoned to life, etc. A stream which flowed uninterruptedly through all those decades, whether Leninist norms were infringed or strictly observed, and flowed in Khrushchev's day more furiously than ever. I mean the believers, those who resisted the new wave of cruel persecution, the wholesale closing of churches. Monks who were slung out of their monasteries. Krasnov-Levitin has given us a great deal of information about this. Stubborn sectarians, especially those who refuse to perform military service. There's nothing we can do about it. We're really very sorry, but you're directly aiding imperialism. We let you off lightly nowadays. It's 5 years first time around. These are in no sense politicals. They are religionists. But still, they have to be re-educated. Believers must be dismissed from their jobs merely for their faith. Komsomols must be sent along to break the windows of believers. Believers must be officially compelled to attend anti-religious lectures. Church doors must be cut down with blowtorches. Domes pulled down with hawsers attached to tractors. Gatherings of old women broken up with fire hoses. Is this what you meant by dialogue, French comrades? As the monks of the Pochayev Monastery were told in the Soviet of Workers' Deputies, if we always observe Soviet laws, we shall have to wait a long time for communism. Only in extreme cases, when educational methods do not help, is recourse to the law necessary. Here we can dazzle the world with the diamond pure nobility of our laws today. We no longer try people in closed courts, as under Stalin. We no longer try them in absentia. We try them semi-publicly, that is to say, in the presence of a semi-public. I hold in my hand a record of the trial of some Baptists at Nikitovka in the Donbass in January 1964. This is how it's done. On the pretense that their identity must be checked, the Baptists who arrived to attend the trial were held in jail for 3 days until the trial was over and to give them a fright. Someone, a free citizen, who threw flowers to the defendants, got 10 days. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.